Hello and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Mehrzad Borujerdi about his new book, Post-Revolutionary Iran, a Political Handbook. Mehrzad, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and your own background and intellectual development.
Thank you, James, for having me in this program. I'm a political scientist by training. I came to the United States in 1978, which coincided with the outbreak of the earliest signs of the revolutionary movement in Iran. And initially, my plan was to become a petroleum engineer in the U.S., but I was so engulfed in everything that was going on in Iran that I decided to go and study political science and sociology, really to make sense of the Iranian Revolution. And that became my career. And I have been teaching political science at Syracuse University in upstate New York for the last 26 years, and have been studying Iran for the last 40 years or so in an academic capacity. Much of my work up to this point really had to do with intellectual history. So, for example, my first book entitled Iranian Intellectuals and the West, The Tormented Triumph of Nativism, presented a theory about the Iranian Revolution in the context of what I called nativism. In other words, people's desire to have an authentic identity of their own as they confronted the onslaught of Western modernity. I argued in that book, forced Iranians to try to rediscover what it is that gives them a sense of authentic identity. And of course, Shiite Islam in this particular case, proved to be the answer. So the argument of that book was basically that the revolution didn't happen just because there was a charismatic leader like Ayatollah Khomeini, but that there were a lot of people who paved the way for this discourse that he managed to tap into in a very professional manner that had been articulated by intellectuals. As they saw the change, the pace of reforms in Iran under the Shah. That was the initial work on intellectual history, but I have also been studying Iranian politics, sort of current politics, day to day politics, and gradually grew rather dissatisfied with our state of knowledge on Iran, because I thought that basically what we have comes down to rather simplistic or naive journalism pieces or highly partisan works being produced by either Western think tanks or supporters of the Iranian government. And much of this work really wasn't necessarily based on hard data. So that's how I became interested in doing my recent book on post-revolutionary politics in Iran, which I'd be happy to say more about.
Sure. Just one question. When you left Iran in 1978, which was a year before the revolution, was that coincidental that it was a year before the revolution, or were you actually leaving because you saw developments?
No, it was totally coincidental. I was 16 years old at the time, so really had no conception of what was about to unfold, in Iran. It was, I had basically expressed an interest to my parents to go and study in the U.S., and they decided that was the time for me, to do it. Little did I know that a week after, I arrived in the United States, martial law regime will be instituted in Iran and the revolution will begin to gain momentum.
Right. This is looking at the book, it's a worth love, if you wish. I just had to turn something off, so let's start this over again. Basically, Let me just, so we don't get the sounds anymore. Okay. I mean, looking at the book that you did together with Farouk Rahim Khani, this is a work of love. I mean, it's an 900 pages of meticulously put together raw data. As such, probably the foremost handbook on the political elite and political processes in Iran. What did you expect to achieve with that?
Right. So you're absolutely right that this is a labor of love. It took me 14 years really to write this book. You can imagine the fact that the book starts, you know, right before the revolution, before the age of the internet. So how difficult it was to gather the data, you know, let's say regarding elections or biographies of, you know, political figures. So there is a, you know, a logic to the madness of why it took 14 years really to assemble such a manuscript in 900 pages. So what I hope to do with this book was that again realizing that a rather dramatic revolution had happened in Iran, the first revolution in modern history that had led to the establishment of a theocratic state, where there was no ready blueprint for the new folks who came to power to follow. And therefore, these guys, you know, adopted a style of trial and error in terms of their model of a statecraft. And I realized that, you know, again, in the Western academic and, you know, journalistic circles, our knowledge about these folks was rather a skin deep, right? In other words, people, you know, had heard about the biography of, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini or the, you know, nuclear negotiator and these type of folks, but really had no idea, based on empirical research, about this whole generation of people who came to power after 1979. So realizing that there was no reliable who is who for post-revolutionary Iran, that's why I decided to, you know, put together this, you know, this book, which not only has biographical sketches of over 2,300 leading politicians from day one of the revolution up to the present time, but also has, you know, a treasure trove of information regarding anything you need to know about Iranian politics, like electoral results, political parties, who is related to whom in terms of, you know, family ties and things of that sort. The book starts with a 30-page chronology of the major events that have happened in Iran over, you know, the last 40 years. So really, my purpose in this thing was to make sure that the reader has sort of, you know, can do a one-stop shop type of thing and have at his or her disposal all the facts that will be needed to make sense of the revolution and what has happened in the first four decades of it. Also, I wanted to preserve, for the sake of, you know, historical memory, an account of the actors who were involved, played a big role in this revolution. So, in you know, between the lines of the biographies, you can really see the story of a revolution unfold. In my view, how people's careers, excuse me, move and change, how they go up the social ladder, and what type of challenges they faced, and the like. So right now, this book, which is based on a database that we created, which has, you know, over 100,000 points of data. In other words, for each individual, for the 2,300 individual in the database, we assembled 50 different categories of information. So as far as I know, this is really now the largest database on political elite anywhere in Middle East and North Africa. I don't know of any other country that has, had an extensive and comprehensive database like the one that we have assembled.
I think you're probably right on that. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, go ahead.
If you want to just go ahead, please do.
I just wanted to say so that, you know, this database, which I'm hoping at some point I would be able to, put on the internet in a way that can be useful to the general public, will now allow us for the first time to, analyze Iranian politics based on facts and not based on, let's say a journalist going to Iran for a week or so and coming back with this, impressions of what he or she saw in the limited time period that they were there. So the advantage of having a longitudinal study like this one is that it sort of documents and helps us with the raw material that is needed for any type of researcher who wants to investigate various aspects of Iranian politics. So in other words, I think we have shared our data sandbox with the world, really. And future researchers, based on their interest, can decide what they want to do, what, they want to investigate. For example, let's say a researcher interested in women's issues might want to know what voting districts in Iran have voted for women and what is the degree of socioeconomic development of that region. So that becomes one line of investigation, where we have, paved the way and provided the raw material for people to use.
So I think there's no doubt you've created a unique reference book for any researcher on Iran, the likes of which do not exist for any other country in the Middle East. Before I come back to the book, I want to briefly come back to something that you said at the beginning of the conversation, where you said, you had a revolution and the coming to power of a group that had no blueprint. And I think that's certainly true for the Islamic scholars, so for Khomeini and all the others. You also had at the time, an effort to create a blueprint. I'm thinking, for example, of Mehdi Bazargan's son-in-law, Hussein Banasidi, who was hard at work in the year before the revolution to try and work out a blueprint of what an Islamic state would look like.
Correct. That's correct. So basically what happened was that while Ayatollah Khomeini was in exile, he tapped a few of his trusted lieutenants to basically draft sort of the constitution for the new state. And these people went to work, mainly made up of lawyers and a couple of social scientists. And they basically looked at various constitutions, in particular the French constitution, the Belgian constitution, etc., and borrowed elements from that and tried to reconcile this with the basic tenets of the Islamic Sharia. So what we ended up with was a rather eclectic document that this gentleman had put together. And then in the early days of the revolution, there was an assembly which was formed to ratify the draft of this, constitution. So things changed dramatically in the course of the discussions of this, group. For example, this idea that we now know and identify Iran with, the idea of the mandate of the jurisconsult or the theory of Velayat Faqih, a supreme, sort of philosopher king ruling Iran. So when you look at the early drafts of the constitution, there was no such office, envisioned. However, later, as the debates within the assembly took place, here now you had a lot of heavyweight clerics, presenting their views, and not just a bunch of lay lawyers and attorneys. And therefore, the tenor of discussion changed a bit, and we ended up with a constitution that, frankly, is to this day remains extremely eclectic in terms of its nature. So when you look at the Iranian constitution, you see that it's sort of one clause can contradict the other. At one point, it says, sovereignty emanates from people, and therefore people's vote is what defines the system. And then later on, there is a reference to the buck stops with the supreme leader, and that he can basically overrule anything that he sees as not being compatible with the tenets of Sharia, including, of course, people's votes in that regard. So so I think that eclecticism has certainly stayed with us. It is true, as I try to demonstrate in the book, that the post-revolutionary state borrowed many of the institutions of the ancien regime under the Shah, right? So, for example, the parliament, the state, cabinet, the state, and military establishment and the like. However, what these guys did was that they also created a whole host of rather novel institutions that does not exist in any other country. So, for example, creating an institution called the Guardian Council, or the Assembly of Religious Experts, or the Expediency Council, or for that matter, they went and created parallel organizations and institutions. So we ended up with not only the regular military, but also the famous Revolutionary Guards, for example, as two parallel military institutions in Iran. So, as I said before, this was a case of trial and error, and the state basically created institutions as it gradually matured and realized what are the challenges and how they can they better deal with issues. At some points, they ended many of those institutions that they had created because of turf wars between actor A and actor B. So it's still a work in progress.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Although in the case of the Revolutionary Guards, which were really created because they distrusted the military, and they distrusted it from day one. In some ways, you could argue the parallel of that for the longest period of time was the separation of military powers in Saudi Arabia between the military and the National Guard. But coming back to the Constitution for a second, beyond the concept of the Velayat Faqih, probably the most controversial clause in that in that constitution, certainly internationally, is the whole concept of the export of the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're right. When we study revolutions, we see these attempt of revolutionaries to be really quite ambitious, right? They basically think that the best defense is offense. So whether it's the Cuban Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the idea was that, if we do not export our revolution, the enemies of revolution or outside powers are going to, suffocate us. And therefore, just like the other revolutionary counterparts, Iranian revolutionary leaders were very optimistic that they will be able to export their revolution to neighboring states. In particular, they were hoping that this can happen in places like Iraq next door, where the ties between the Iranian clerics and the Iraqi clerical families, you know, extends to, you know, a few centuries, as well as in a place like Lebanon, which where, again, there is a sizable Shiite, you know, community. However, what we ended up learning really in practice was that these results did not produce the intended outcome. There was no replica of Iran established, you know, anywhere as a bona fide, you know, theocratic state. Not to say that the Iranians did not try, but other factors intervened, right? So the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, for example, diminished the value of the Iranian model in the eyes of many Iraqis who might have perhaps looked at it more, you know, sympathetically in the early days, or Lebanon's multi-ethnic, multi-religious, you know, demographic composition did not necessarily lend itself to that vision of Velayat-e-Faqih or the Iranian model of theocracy. And I think, you know, also the fact that Shiism, as the state religion in Iran, as the language, as the discourse of the revolutionary practice, you know, had a hard time sort of resonating and captivating the predominantly Sunni Arab world in that regard. So, in other words, the model itself also had certain shortcomings that, you know, became evident, you know, in the later decades as we moved away from the events of 1979.
Let me throw another aspect of this at you. You tell me whether the data that you compiled in the book bears this out. And that is that, you know, if you look at the first year of the revolution, you know, the days when you had the Islamic Front for the Liberation of Bahrain and the Diwan of Ayatollah Montazeri, sort of passed on with the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq War. And in a sense, you had a transition from that revolutionary, religiously driven revolutionary zeal into what has become Iranian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you would say is borne out or contradicted in your book?
No, I think you're right, and that's true. Again, I go back to the Iran-Iraq War, right? So the Iranian clergymen have had a rather uncomfortable relationship with Iranian nationalism. However, because, you know, frankly, they thought secular nationalism was the ideological backbone of the Shah's state. And since they were hard at work to create an alternative, you know, ideological model that is based on revolutionary Shiism, they did not want to pay homage that much to Iranian nationalism. However, the Iran-Iraq War forced the hands of the Iranian clerics to come to terms with the appeal of Iranian nationalism. For example, they realized one way of mobilizing the citizenry, you know, to make sacrifices, to send their sons to fight on the fronts, was to formulate the issue as, you know, safeguarding the motherland against, you know, Iraqi invaders. And that sentiment certainly resonated with many Iranians. Let me just say this. I come from the Khuzestan region of Iran, mm-hmm. Near the Iraqi border. And, you know, indeed, many of my high school buddies ended up going and fighting and getting killed in the Iran-Iraq War, not because they were any type of, you know, religious fanatics, but rather because their sense of Iranian nationalism dictated to them that they need to go and, you know, fight in this war. So whereas the Iranian state, of course, likes to still portray everything as if this was motivated by the appeal of Ayatollah Khomeini and the revolutionary message of Shiism and nothing else, the reality is much more complicated, right? The citizenry who went to fight in the war were motivated not just by religious zeal, but by this type of nationalist sentiments as well. And more broadly, I mean, forgetting the Iran-Iraq war, what we have seen is that the state, even though it has continued its onslaught and an attempt to try to marginalize the sense of Iranian nationalism, they realize that this is an uphill battle, right? Whether it's in soccer fields where that type of sentiment manifests itself, whether it's in celebration of Nowruz, the Persian New Year events, etc., the government realizes that it is very hard to try to sort of badmouth or reduce the appeal of this sense of Iranian nationalism. It can come handy for them as well. So why not use that as a sort of a second line of reasoning to win over the citizenry?
Khuzestan, of course, was particularly relevant, one, because it was a major battlefield in the Iran-Iraq war, and because it also has a significant citizenry of Arab origin.
Correct. Yep. That's exactly the case. And, it's the oil-rich region of Iran, of course, produces much of the country's wealth. But unfortunately, it is not an estate, it is not a province that has really received much attention from the state. So, some of the poorest areas of Iran are located there, and the ethnic tensions have a state to this day, and they flare up from time to time.
Indeed. I want to return to the book itself, and particularly to your introduction, where a number of things struck my fancy. You, at one point in your introduction, speak about the secularization of the clergy, and I wonder whether you could elaborate on that.
Sure. So basically, the argument I want to make is that the clerics, when they came to power, frankly, they had no idea what they were getting into, right? So they had no conception of how difficult it was to run the machinery of a modern day state. For example, a country like Iran, a major oil producing state, single, based economy on oil. And they got themselves into all sorts of troubles, and they had to learn on the job how it was that international transactions was working, etc. So gradually the government had to come to terms, whether it was because of the hostage crisis and the pressure exerted on them by the international community, particularly the United States, whether
You're referring to the occupation of the U.S. embassy.
Or whether it was the necessities of the Iran-Iraq war that forced them to that realization, or the massive drop in the price of oil in the 1980s that at one point went down to less than around $10 a barrel. Those realities forced the state to become more attentive, right, to international realities. Also, the other thing that happened in terms of secularization was that they realized they have to work within the confines of these institutions that they had borrowed from the pre-revolutionary period. So in other words, if there is elections for the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, therefore, clerics, like everybody else, had to compete in that electoral landscape, learn the game, learn, how you come up with the slogans, platforms, and the like, to win over your constituencies. And gradually then what happens was that they realized that their religiously confined message, worldview, was not sufficient enough to attract a large base, right? So they had to, therefore, delve into other areas. The other thing that happened was that again, the needs of a modern state in the 20th or 21st century basically meant that you need technocrats. You know, what's the point of putting clerics, let's say, in cabinet positions where they do not have any type of expertise, right? A cleric cannot necessarily be the best minister of agriculture or minister of petroleum and the like. So therefore, what happens under the Islamic Republic is what I call the emergence of a second layer, a layer of lay religious technocrats who, basically come and work shoulder to shoulder with the clerics in terms of running the state. And here, the logic of technocrats, takes over. So, for example, let's say the Iran-Iraq war ends and President Rafsanjani has surrounded himself with this type of technocrats, and they are telling him, well, okay, this is the time for reconstruction of a war-torn economy, and you need to do X, Y, and Z in this regard, okay? And so they go about doing these type of things. Or let's say the challenge of dealing with Iranian women, where, the government has basically tried to, deprive them of certain rights, but not necessarily others. Why? Because the backlash from the public in terms of, putting up a fight regarding taking away, many of their rights, whether it's, rights of, let's say, divorce, custody, and getting elected to certain offices, etc. And they have seen these processes. So once you put all these things together, and as I said at the beginning, starting with the assumption that this was an eclectic state to begin with, what we see is the gradual emergence of more secular outlooks dominating, the Iran's political landscape. For example, under President Khatami, one of his favorite slogans was "Iran for all Iranians, regardless of the horizontal and vertical cleavages that exist within the society there." So what does that slogan mean? Does that include, therefore, atheistic Iranians who don't believe in God, etc.? How do you deal with the sizable Iranian community, the expat community outside the country, where you need their money, you need their know-how, resources at their disposal, etc.? So that's why we see this gradual secularization of politics. And one other point I want to add is that certain Islamic thinkers, for example, the philosopher Abdul Karim al-Surush, who has played a really big role in all of this thing, basically they made the argument that, listen, by mixing religion and politics, the one that bends the knee to the other is religion, not politics, right? It is religion that needs to adjust itself to the everyday realities of politics, not the other way around. And therefore, these guys argued that you have basically taken away one of the most cherished values of religion, which is supposed to be, divorced from this materialistic, wishes of citizen. But now religion has become an instrument of a state, an instrument of governing. So we can execute people and say, this is because of Islam. So these guys have argued that basically you have given religion a bad name by making it into the servant of politics and not necessarily its master. So secularization of thought in that sense has also come about.
I'm sorry. I want to return for a moment to your concept of the religious technocrats and juxtapose that with the revolution itself and then the immediate period after the revolution, whereas during the revolution itself, you had essentially a coalition whereby not less religiously driven forces or non-religious forces I'm sorry, whereby less religiously driven forces and non-religious forces were convinced that the clergy would need them to run the state. And Bazargan was basically seen as an exponent of that. And yet, the fall of the Bazargan government was also viewed as the defeat of the technocrats.
Correct. So you're absolutely right that in the early days of the revolution, if you look at the makeup, for example, of the Revolutionary Council that Ayatollah Khomeini created while he was in exile in France, the makeup of that group, which is listed in my book, by the way, encompasses both clerics and, lay religious intellectuals and politicians, the like of, Mehdi Bazargan. However, what happened in the early days of the revolution was that this technocratic elite, this liberal elite, were basically marginalized as the clerics started to gain the upper hand. Please remember that in the early days of the revolution, none of the clerics was occupying a ministerial post, right? So, for example, the current supreme leader, Khamenei, his very first job was a deputy to a layman who was minister of defense. So Khamenei started as that. Hashemi Rafsanjani, another leading figure of the revolution, his first job after the revolution was, deputy interior minister. Okay, but then they learned, on the job, and at first Ayatollah Khomeini did not want the clerics to be the country's president. That's how we ended up with somebody like Bani Sadr as the first post-revolutionary president. However, things began to change, as the attacks by the Mujahideen Khal on the state, started claiming the lives of many leading, clerics. Ayatollah Khomeini and his lieutenants decided that, we need to have a firm grip on what is happening in the country, and therefore he put his, trusted lieutenants in important positions, including the presidency that Mr. Khamenei occupied for, 8 years, followed by Rafsanjani for 8 years, etc. However, Bazargan and that, group of liberal Muslim intellectuals were forced out. But the state still needed to generate, right, a second generation of technocrats to run the machinery of the state. And I think this is the group that we know the least about in the Western world, right? We have the biographies of some leading clerics. But for example, every time I go to Washington, D.C. and talk to the government officials and say, U.S. government officials and say, if I ask you for 5 minutes, right, can you talk intelligently only for 5 minutes, no more, about what is the collective picture of, let's say, the gentlemen who serve as Iran's governor generals in the 31 provinces of Iran. The room goes silent because we know nothing about the background of these individuals, right? Or if I ask them, what is the profile of an Iranian diplomat, an ambassador, etc. So this is the generation that we don't know about. And that's why I'm hopeful that this book will be so useful to the people who are interested in this type of issues, to be able to look up the biographies of people and say, wait a minute, how did somebody like, let's say, Javad Zarif, the current foreign minister, where did he go to school? How old was he when he got this position or that position and the like? So that you can see the evolution of these individuals who have come through the ranks and now constitute the backbone of the state. Let me add this, James, that, of the more than 2,300 people who are in my database, only two or three had an important political position, for example, serving in parliament before the revolution. Everybody else is brand new, right? So 99.9% of the people who are, you know, occupying important positions in Iran now are brand new. And therefore, it is crucially important for us to know something about their background, upbringing, you know, ethnicity, educational pedigree, and the like.
I want to come back to something that you said early on in the interview, which you spoke about basically a hybrid. So the new regime taking over some of the institutions of the former regime and creating its own institutions at the same time. Yet, if I recall correctly, in the introduction to your book, you talk about the importance of personal relationships rather than institutional relationships. Can you bring the two in harmony with each other for me?
Sure. Yeah. So let's start with the institutions, right? As you rightfully pointed out, for example, when it came to the military establishment, because the new regime did not trust the military regime that was basically, made by the Shah, they created the Revolutionary Guards as a parallel organization, which is a long-established practice in the Middle East. We can trace it back to the Janissary force of the Ottoman Empire that was, you know, performing the same type of function, or Saddam's Republican Guards and the like. All right. But that was not the only one, right? You know, for example, you had therefore a Ministry of Agriculture, but also a Ministry of Agricultural Jihad that was created. Basically trying to do other types of revolutionary activity in the realm of agriculture. As I point out in the book, and, you know, one of the fascinating things I think in the book is that I point out year by year, what were the new revolutionary institutions that the new state created? And we list over, 80, 90 of them that I was able to count that the state created. So this was the necessity. This was, you know, what they felt, having a theocratic state really requires. Okay. Social engineering, in other words, and networking has been very crucial to the clerics. And, you look at somebody like the current supreme leader, Khamenei, he's a micromanager. He is an institutional man. And therefore, you know, wants to make sure that, let's say, the Friday prayer leaders around the country are appointed by him in the major centers, and that they basically they receive their talking points on a weekly basis from his office so that they know what it is that they are supposed to be preaching to the public every Friday. What I say regarding the individual networks, I don't think necessarily negates this fact. You see, what happens in Iran is that the clerics have a very extensive network, as we know, and again in the last section of the book where I mentioned the family ties, I have tried to document this. Clerical families end up marrying into each other. Okay, that has been a long-established, practice, and this way you will see how the family ties between elites in many ways can explain many of the positions that they have adopted. If you do not have access to this sort of inside baseball information, we are often puzzled by why did, you know, person X say, you know, such and such, and person Y, for example, supported him or opposed him, then, you know, some of these family ties becomes rather important in that regard. Keep in mind that the circle of trust among many of these Iranian politicians is very limited. I find it fascinating that, you know, presidents such as, you know, Rafsanjani, Khatami, Ahmadinejad, and now Rouhani, each of these folks basically tapped their brothers to either be their chief of staff in the president's office or to be one of their closest advisors, right? Which tells you something about the significance of these, networks and ties, and how things are done. And then, you know, you have also this other phenomena that, again, we document in the book. A person like Khamenei as the supreme leader, he basically handpicks over 400 individuals, right? And he appoints them to important posts in the country. For example, his personal representatives at universities or his personal representatives in province X and Y. Now, you look at the background of these individuals who are being tapped for these positions, and you know, you see, aha, here is the ties. For example, many of the individuals who served as ministers when Mr. Khamenei was president for 8 years, he has remained very loyal to them and has kept them in various capacities. Case in point is Ali Akbar Velayati, a former foreign minister, you know, who served 16 years as Iran's foreign minister, 8 years of those under Khamenei as president. And then, you know, once he was out in 1997, Khamenei then brought him into his own circle and appointed him as a foreign policy advisor and appointed him to some, you know, posts where he can still stay relevant. So it is, in my view, of utmost significance for us to be able to detect where these personal ties are and how they work.
You spoke about the importance of social engineering and extensively about social relationships. Yet you stressed in the introduction to the book that you were not looking at the social impact of the revolution.
Right. Right. That was beyond the scope of the work because, again, as you can see, when I wrote this thing, it was 2,200 pages, and my publisher said, "Enough, stop." Right. So there are a lot of number of things that I didn't. For example, I did not look at the economic elite. I was not interested in doing a discourse analysis on the elite. I was not interested in looking at social impacts of these individuals because, again, that would have been a never-ending project. Basically, the way I set the agenda for myself was that I want to look at the politically relevant elite and not just all elites, right? So, for example, in the book, you know, I don't cover ambassadors. I don't cover the provincial, you know, governor generals. I wanted to look at the top of the political pyramid in Iran, which again had 2,300 individuals in it. In other words, anything in parliament, anyone in ministers serving as cabinet minister, anybody serving in such crucial institutions as the Guardian Council, Assembly of Religious Experts, Expediency Council, heads of, you know, Revolutionary Guards or the military establishment, you know, leading officials in the judiciary. This was the constituency that I was interested in and not necessarily, you know, going down the ladder because, again, it would have been awfully difficult in terms of data collection to be able to compile a comprehensive list of everybody who has served in these positions. Unfortunately, data collection and data preservation in Iran, especially in the early days of the revolution, was not that great, and therefore it would have been an impossible task.
Mehrzad, I've taken up a lot of your time. To round this up, tell me where are you going from here with the book? What's your next project?
So, I am interested in experimentation. So my first book, as I said, was a work of intellectual history. Then I decided to do this book, which was, heavy empirical work. And, frankly, I learned a lot in terms of doing empirical work, number crunching and so forth, rather than abstract theorizing. But now for my next project, I think I want to continue with my experimentation. And I want to basically write my personal story and that of my family's involvement with the revolution, you know, in a subjective manner from my lens, because I think, you know, again, what is fascinating about my generation is that we saw some amazing, you know, events back to back, outlandish events from the revolution to the hostage crisis to the Iran-Iraq war, to the economic embargoes that Iran faced, and you know the maturation process of a new generation, the splits and the cleavages that emerged among the revolutionary elites, relationship between expats and those inside Iran. So I have a story to tell from a personal lens, and I'm hoping that basically my previous work, both the theoretical work and the empirical work, will be laying the foundation for the story I want to say in my next project.
You no doubt have a fascinating story to tell, and I will look forward to reading that. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and I learned a lot. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.